Usually, when we talk about crime scene investigation, there's this expectation of a logical trail.
Right, a sequence of events.
Exactly. You picture the shattered window, maybe a footprint in the mud, or a fingerprint left carelessly on a glass. The detective walks into the room, gathers the physical evidence, and it all points just inevitably toward a suspect.
Yeah, it's a process of deduction, really, that relies on basic cause and effect. I mean, you assume a natural mechanism, you find the clues, and they just assemble themselves into a coherent narrative of, well, what happened in that room?
But then you step into the ultimate scientific cold case, the origin of life on Earth, and suddenly that whole deductive process just it gets completely turned upside down.
Oh, absolutely.
We walk into the primordial crime scene looking for the suspect that created the very first biological code. We're looking for the blind, unguided forces of nature that supposedly, wrote the software of life. But as we comb through the chemical evidence, it doesn't just fail to point to a suspect, it actively, aggressively points away.
It is the absolute definition of a forensic paradox. When you look closely at the physics and the organic chemistry, the environment itself seems to be destroying the evidence faster than it could ever be created. The laws of nature appear actively hostile to the very outcome we are trying to explain.
So we are going on an epic scientific detective story today to track down the origin of the biological code. And our source material for this deep dive is an incredibly dense, just fascinating 2026 dissertation titled The Origin Enigma by Mohammed Tariq Arbab.
Yeah, it's a text that pulls absolutely no punches. It takes this deeply multidisciplinary approach spanning cosmology, physics, organic chemistry, and even information theory.
And it essentially performs a rigorous, unsparing audit of the prevailing scientific theories. It looks at what the known laws of physics and chemistry actually do when left entirely to their own devices, without an intelligent scientist actively interfering in the laboratory.
Right, it's purely about unguided nature.
Now, before we really get into the weeds here, I want to be crystal clear with you, the listener. This text explicitly challenges the mainstream naturalistic paradigm of how life began. It confronts the idea that blind chemistry could organically assemble living cells. And our job here today is not to take sides.
Exactly. We're just looking at the data.
Right. We are not endorsing the viewpoints in this text, nor are we casually dismissing them. Our mission is to impartially unpack the highly detailed arguments and the empirical data presented in the source. We are just playing the role of the detectives, looking at the case files exactly as they are laid out on the desk.
It's an evaluation of the physical evidence. We are taking the chemical realities of the early Earth and, well, putting them right on the witness stand.
So we're going to start by looking at the physics clues that set the cosmic stage. Then we're going to zoom in on a highly detailed exploration of Chapter 2, mapping out exactly how the fundamental laws of chemistry act as these massive, towering barriers to life's origin.
Yeah, the chemical hurdles are just staggering once you dig into them.
We'll explore the specific paradoxes of water, the geometry of molecules, the inescapable problem of chemical tar. And finally, we'll wrap it all up into a quick, easily digestible study guide for you to take away. Okay, let's unpack this. To understand the origin of life, we first have to understand the universe that houses it.
That's the critical starting point, for sure. For a very long time in human history, basically from Aristotle right up through the early 20th century, science operated on the assumption that the universe was just, an eternal given.
Just a static background.
Right. It was self-sufficient. It didn't have a beginning. It was just a static, infinite reality.
It was the ultimate backdrop. You didn't question the stage, you just watched the play taking place on it. You assume there's unlimited time and unlimited space for things to just happen.
But 20th century physics completely shattered that assumption. I mean, the development of Big Bang cosmology and the Standard Model of Particle Physics revealed a universe that had a highly specific beginning. It was definitely not eternal.
Which changes everything.
It does. And more importantly, this realization shifted the entire scientific conversation from this loose idea of blind chance to this inescapable, mathematically rigorous concept of fine-tuning.
When you say fine-tuning, you mean that the fundamental forces of the universe are dialed to incredibly specific numbers, right? The text highlights a few historical breakthroughs here that are just mind-bending. It brings up the physicist Robert Dicke in 1961. What exactly was he looking at?
So Dicke was looking at the fundamental forces that govern the universe, specifically the relationship between the electromagnetic force and the gravitational force. If you want a universe that can actually support life, you absolutely must have stars.
Because they make the elements.
Exactly. Stars are the massive furnaces that forge the heavy elements required for biology. things like carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen. This process is called nucleosynthesis. But for a star to burn long enough to forge those elements, there is a very delicate balancing act. Gravity is constantly trying to crush the star inward, while electromagnetism, driving the nuclear fusion, pushes radiation outward.
So it's like a cosmic tug of war. Gravity pulls in, the nuclear explosions push out.
Precisely. Dick discovered that the ratio between electromagnetism and gravity has to be balanced to an exact mathematical degree. That ratio is 10 to the power of 39.
Okay, wait. 10 to the power of 39, that is a 1 followed by 39 zeros. That's 10,000 billion 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 billion.
Yeah, it's incomprehensible.
How fragile is that ratio, really? Like, what happens if we tweak it just a little bit?
Well, if you alter that ratio, even fractionally, say, you make gravity slightly stronger. Stars burn through their nuclear fuel at catastrophic rates. Instead of burning stably for billions of years, giving planets time to form and chemistry to happen, they collapse and burn out in thousands of years.
Wow, so no time for anything.
Right. And if you make gravity slightly weaker, matter never coalesces into stable stellar furnaces in the first place. You just get a diffuse, cold, dead universe. The existence of a life-permitting universe teeters on that exact razor's edge.
That is just staggering. But it doesn't stop with just the formation of stars, does it? The text dives into the work of Sir Fred Hoyle in the 1950s, which is honestly one of the most fascinating scientific detective stories on its own. Hoyle was trying to figure out where carbon comes from, right?
Yeah, because the Big Bang essentially only gave us hydrogen and a little bit of helium.
So how do we get the carbon that literally every single living thing is built from?
That was the great mystery. In stellar nucleosynthesis, stars crush hydrogen into helium. The next logical step to build heavier elements would be to smash two helium nuclei together. But when you do that, you get an isotope called beryllium-8. And here's the kinetic bottleneck. Beryllium-8 is incredibly violently unstable. Its half-life is around 10 to the power of negative 17 seconds.
Wait, negative 17? It practically disappears the moment it forms. It's a phantom element.
It really is. So to get carbon, which requires three helium nuclei, a third helium nucleus has to hit that beryllium-8 target within that infinitesimal fraction of a second before it decays.
That sounds impossible.
It gets worse. Just hitting it isn't enough. For the newly formed carbon nucleus to hold together, the energies of the colliding particles must align perfectly.
It's like trying to shoot a bullet out of the air with another bullet, but while riding a roller coaster blindfolded.
That is a great way to picture it.
So Hoyle realized that for this fusion to actually work and produce the vast amounts of carbon we see in the universe, the carbon-12 nucleus had to possess a very specific hidden property. What was it?
He calculated that the carbon-12 nucleus must possess an exact, highly specific energy state, a resonance at precisely 7.65 million electron volts. If carbon-12 does not have a resonance at that exact energy level, the stellar furnaces simply cannot make carbon.
At all?
At all. The universe would be a sterile, dead wasteland composed almost entirely of hydrogen and helium.
And he basically walked down the hall, told the experimental physicists to go look for this exact resonance, and against all odds, they found it. Exactly where his math said it had to be.
Yeah, they did. And Hoyle's own reaction to this discovery is deeply telling. He was an outspoken atheist. He was not predisposed to see teleology or purpose or design in nature at all.
Right.
But when he saw the hyper-precision required to forge carbon, he publicly admitted that a common-sense interpretation of the facts suggested that a super-intellect had monkeyed with physics, as well as with chemistry and biology. He literally said there were no blind forces worth speaking about in nature.
Because it just looks incredibly rigged. I mean, the physical parameters are too perfect. And if we zoom out even further from carbon, we get to the cosmologist Roger Penrose. He starts looking at the Big Bang itself, specifically the initial entropy of the universe.
This is a huge one.
For those of us who haven't taken thermodynamics recently, what do we mean by entropy in this context?
Entropy is essentially a thermodynamic measure of disorder. The second law of thermodynamics tells us that systems naturally degrade from order to disorder over time. A hot cup of coffee cools down, a sandcastle washes away, you know.
Things break down.
Exactly. So for the universe to have a forward arrow of time, to be able to form galaxies, stars, planets, and the temperature gradients that drive chemistry, it had to begin its life in a state of exceptionally low entropy. It had to start with maximum order.
But statistically, there are infinitely more ways for a system to be messy and disordered than there are for it to be perfectly organized.
A high-entropy, disordered, chaotic start to the universe is vastly, incomprehensibly more probable. So Penrose set out to calculate the required precision for the Big Bang to have that initial life-permitting low-entropy state.
I remember reading this number in the source text, and it's one of those figures that is so large it almost loses meaning. Can you walk us through Penrose's calculation?
Sure. Penrose calculated that the initial state of the universe had to be fine-tuned to an accuracy of 1 part in 10 to the power of 10 to the power of 123.
That's a double exponential.
It is a mathematical monstrosity. To give you some context for just how precise that is, imagine trying to write out that number. It would be a 1 followed by 10 to the power of 123 zeros.
Okay.
If you were to take a microscopic pen and write a 0 on every single subatomic particle in the entire observable universe, every proton, every neutron, every electron, you would run out of particles long, long before you finished writing the zeros for that number.
Oh my God. So you literally cannot write the number out in the physical universe. It breaks the bounds of physical reality.
It completely shatters the conceptual bounds of probability. When you are dealing with a required precision of 1 part in 10 to the 123, you have moved far beyond the realm where chance is a meaningful scientific explanation.
Right. Chance is basically zero.
And the text points out that this fine-tuning extends everywhere. The cosmological constant dark energy, the vacuum energy of empty space that pushes the universe apart, has to be tuned to 1 part in 10 to the power of 120.
And what happens if it's off?
If it's a microscopic fraction stronger, the universe blows apart so fast that stars and galaxies never form. If it's a microscopic fraction weaker, gravity overpowers it, and the universe collapses back in on itself in a fiery crunch immediately after the Big Bang.
So synthesizing this first part of the detective story, the author is establishing that the fundamental physical laws of the universe do not operate loosely. They operate with a mathematical hyper-precision that allows chemistry to even exist. This fine-tuning is the absolute prerequisite. The cosmic stage was built perfectly.
Yes. Physics provides the platform. It provides the heavy elements, the stable stars, the planetary systems.
But hold on. I'm going to push back here, acting as the skeptical detective. Earth has been around for 4 billion years. The universe is incredibly vast. If the physics of the universe is perfectly rigged to allow for planets, stars, and chemistry, doesn't that mean life should just inevitably pop up everywhere?
That's the common assumption.
Right. If the stage is set that perfectly and you roll the dice for billions of years, doesn't the play just naturally write itself eventually?
That was definitely the foundational assumption of 20th century origin of life research. But the author introduces a concept here called the Great Categorical Shift. Mm-hmm. And this is crucial. While physics provides the abstract potential for life, you know, the raw materials of biology require something entirely different in category.
How so?
Well, the laws of physics operate on universal, repeatable, predictable patterns. Gravity affects every single mass exactly the same way. A sodium atom will bond with a chlorine atom the same way every time to make salt.
It's regular. It's periodic.
Yes. But biology does not run on periodic regularity. Biology depends on specific, aperiodic, information-bearing structures.
Like DNA and proteins.
Exactly. Let's get DNA. The DNA molecule is a physical structure made of sugars, phosphates, and 4 specific chemical bases. The letters. The laws of physics and chemistry dictate how those molecules hold together. They dictate the chemical bonds. But, and this is a vital distinction, the laws of physics do not dictate the sequence of the letters. The letters can be arranged in any order, just like the laws of chemistry governing ink and paper do not dictate the words of a novel.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. The physics of the paper and the ink permit me to write a Shakespearean sonnet, but the physics of the paper doesn't force the ink to arrange itself into a sonnet. I could just as easily spill the ink and make a mess.
Precisely. Moving from physics to biology is a massive categorical shift from predictable matter to semantic information. You are moving from a world of regular physical forces to a world of biological software.
So the cosmic stage is built, the chemical ink and paper are provided by the fine-tuned universe, but the actors, the unguided chemicals, still have to somehow write the play. That brings us to chapter 2, the actual scene of the crime, the early Earth, specifically the Hadean Aeon. And this is where the text performs a ruthless audit on everything we thought we knew about the primordial soup.
For nearly a century, the public and academic imagination has been deeply influenced by an idea Charles Darwin proposed in an 1871 letter to his friend Joseph Hooker. Darwin mused about life beginning in a warm little pond with all sorts of ammonia and phosphoric salts, light, heat, and electricity present.
It's a comforting image, you know. You picture this calm, nutrient-rich, steaming geothermal pool just quietly percolating away, waiting for a dramatic lightning strike to spark life into existence.
It's a beautiful narrative. But the text argues that modern planetary geology paints a violently different picture. The Hadean Earth was not a collection of calm ponds. The entire planet was a macroscopic kinetic reactor defined by overwhelming chaotic destruction. The author identifies three specific environmental realities of this Hadean baseline that completely shatter the warm little pond myth.
Let's walk through those because they are devastating. The first reality the text points out is the dilution problem.
Think about how organic chemistry is done today. A chemist takes highly purified ingredients and concentrates them into a tiny, contained volume, like a glass flask or a test tube. You have to force the molecules into close proximity so they can interact and bond.
You have to push them together.
Right. But the early Earth didn't have glass flasks. It had a nascent planetary-wide ocean with a volume of roughly 10 to the power of 21 liters.
So even if, by some miracle, a lightning strike or a hydrothermal vent manages to synthesize a small batch of organic precursors, say, a few simple amino acids, they don't sit together nicely in a puddle. They're immediately released into this massive churning ocean.
Exactly. They're subjected to instantaneous planetary scale dilution. You completely lose the molecular concentration required to ever link those small building blocks into larger polymers. Biology requires immense sustained concentration. An unguided planetary-sized ocean enforces maximum dispersion.
Okay, so that's dilution. You can't get the parts together. The second reality of the early Earth is UV disassembly.
We really take our modern atmosphere for granted. Our atmosphere contains molecular oxygen, and high up in the stratosphere, that oxygen forms the ozone layer. Ozone acts as a planetary sunscreen, blocking lethal ultraviolet radiation from the sun.
But back then,
in the Hadean Eon, there was no biological life, which meant there was no photosynthesis, which meant there was virtually zero free molecular oxygen in the atmosphere.
And no oxygen means no ozone layer.
Which means the surface of the early Earth and the top layers of its ocean were bombarded continuously by intense, unfiltered UVC radiation from the young sun.
And from a chemical perspective, what does UVC radiation actually do to these delicate organic molecules we need for life?
It acts like a sledgehammer. Ultraviolet radiation possesses enough raw energy to indiscriminately shatter the covalent bonds that hold organic molecules together. Origin of life models often invoke UV light or lightning as the spunk to drive chemical evolution, but the physical reality is that these energy sources are overwhelmingly destructive. They act as mechanisms of molecular disassembly, not assembly.
You can't use a sledgehammer to assemble a watch.
Very true.
Which leads us to the third reality of this environment, the zoo of cross-reacting inhibitors. What does the author mean by that?
In a controlled laboratory setting, a chemist's beaker contains only the specific purified chemicals they want to study. But a natural, primordial environment contains everything. It is a highly contaminated chemical zoo.
It's just a big mess.
Exactly. Any prebiotic pool would have been saturated with reactive metal ions, destructive aldehydes, and hundreds of non-biological molecules that actively compete for chemical reactions.
So to try and picture this, the warm little pond mist is essentially like a perfectly controlled cooking show on TV. The ingredients are perfectly purified and pre-measured into those little glass bowls. The oven is set to the exact right temperature, and the master chef is intelligently guiding every single step of the process.
I like that analogy. But the actual chemistry of the Hadean Earth was less like a cooking show and more like trying to bake a delicate, complex souffle inside a Category 5 hurricane.
Okay.
Yes. The ingredients are blowing everywhere. Intense radiation is blasting the bowl. Random debris is flying into the batter. And there is no chef to protect the process.
That's a grim picture for the origins of life. The text makes a strong point here about thermodynamic endpoints. Without an intelligent investigator to carefully extract waste products, manage the pH, and isolate the right ingredients, the unguided chemical zoo doesn't naturally end up as a living cell, does it?
No, it doesn't. The natural thermodynamic endpoint of an uncontrolled mixture of organic chemicals is a highly cross-linked, disordered polymer matrix. The scientific term is kikerogen. The common term is tar.
Tar.
Yeah. We will dig deeply into the chemistry of tar later in Chapter 2, but for now, understand that the primordial environment was actively hostile to biological complexity.
Okay, so the environment is chaotic, dilute, radioactive, and contaminated. But surely there is a silver lining. let's look for the one thing astrobiologists always tell us to look for when we search for life on Mars or exoplanets. Water.
Ah, yes, water.
Water is the magic ingredient, right? Follow the water. But the author drops a massive scientific bombshell in section 2.3 called the water paradox.
This is one of the most fundamental thermodynamic barriers to the origin of life, and honestly, it rarely gets discussed in popular science. The paradox is this: liquid water is the absolute essential matrix for existing life to survive and metabolize. But chemically speaking, water is actively, aggressively hostile to the formation of life.
Wait, let me make sure I understand this. How can water prevent life from forming if life is literally filled with water? This seems entirely backwards to everything we are taught in school.
I know, it sounds counterintuitive.
Hmm.
It comes down to the fundamental rules of physical chemistry, specifically something called Le Chatelier's principle. Think about the biological macromolecules that make up life. Your proteins, your DNA, your RNA. These are polymers. They are incredibly long chains built by linking smaller pieces monomers together. You link amino acids to build a protein. You link nucleotides to build DNA.
Right, like linking pot beads together to make a necklace.
Exactly. Now, every single time you link two of these biological building blocks together, a specific chemical reaction must occur. It's called a condensation reaction. When the bond forms between two amino acids, an OH group drops off one molecule and a hydrogen atom drops off the other. They combine, and a molecule of water, H2O, is released as a byproduct of forming that link.
Okay, so building the chain actually produces water.
Precisely. And this is where Le Chatelier's principle becomes a devastating barrier. The principle states that a chemical system at equilibrium will dynamically shift to counteract any change you impose on it. If you try to drive a reaction forward that produces a certain byproduct, but you are performing that reaction in an environment that is already completely saturated with that byproduct, the laws of thermodynamics will drive the reaction violently in reverse.
And an ocean is completely saturated with water.
An ocean has a water concentration of roughly 55 molar. It is overwhelmingly saturated. So if you were trying to build a biological chain that releases water, but you were doing it submerged in an ocean, thermodynamics dictates that the chain will not grow. Instead, the water molecules around it will act to aggressively attack and break the chemical bonds you were trying to form.
Oh, wow. This is the process the text calls hydrolysis. Hydro meaning water, lysis meaning to break or unbind.
Yes. Water molecules are highly polar. They pull at the bonds of larger polymers. Placing a growing protein or nucleic acid chain in an aqueous environment doesn't allow it to grow longer. It causes it to rapidly degrade and fall apart back into its individual, disconnected building blocks.
So it's not just that the ocean dilutes the pieces, the water itself is the enemy. It's like trying to build a massive, intricate sandcastle right at the tide line.
That's a great visual.
But from a chemical perspective, it's actually much worse than that. The water doesn't just passively wash the structure away. The water molecules are acting like microscopic chemical scissors. The water is actively dissolving the grains of sand while you were trying to stack them. It is snipping the bonds of the chain faster than blind chemistry can link them together.
And the text provides the specific decay rates and timescales for this destruction, which are devastating for origin of life models that rely on long periods of time.
Mm.
Let's take cytosine, one of the crucial four letter bases of RNA and DNA.
Okay, cytosine.
In water, at comfortable room temperature, cytosine has a half-life of about 340 years before it chemically breaks down. If you put it in the boiling water of a hydrothermal vent, which is a very popular origin of life environment right now, cytosine degrades in mere minutes.
Minutes! You can't build a genetic code in minutes.
You can. And the ribose sugar, which forms the physical backbone of the RNA molecule, it has a half-life of roughly 73 minutes in boiling neutral water before it degrades into non-biological tar.
But hold on. The classic counterargument to all of this is deep time. Earth was lifeless for hundreds of millions of years. If you have an entire planet and millions of years and trillions of chemical reactions happening every second, wouldn't these chains eventually form just by sheer luck? Doesn't deep time eventually solve the problem of improbability?
That is the standard assumption. But the thermodynamic reality of hydrolysis proves the exact opposite. Time is actually the enemy of unguided chemical evolution. You cannot invoke geological timescales to accumulate biological complexity. If your foundational building blocks chemically shred themselves in a matter of minutes, hours, or years.
Because they don't stick around long enough to accumulate.
Exactly. More time does not equal more complexity in an aqueous environment. More time simply guarantees complete thermodynamic degradation. It's like trying to build a skyscraper out of bricks that spontaneously crumble into dust every few hours. Giving the builders a million years doesn't help them build the skyscraper. It just ensures they will always be standing in a pile of dust.
Wow. Time is the enemy. Okay, so water breaks the chains via hydrolysis. The fundamental solvent of life is hostile to its origin. But let's play devil's advocate. Let's pretend we bypass Le Chatelier's principle. Let's say, by some miraculous stroke of luck, a chain of amino acids somehow manages to link together rapidly in a dry microenvironment on land, completely avoiding the water scissors. Do we finally have the beginnings of life?
No, because the moment you bypass the thermodynamic barrier of water, you crash headfirst into a massive geometrical brick wall. The text outlines this in section 2.4 as the chirality hurdle.
The poison pill. This part of the text absolutely blew my mind. Can you explain what chirality is for someone who hasn't taken advanced chemistry?
Sure. Chirality simply means handedness. Because carbon atoms can bond to four different chemical groups in a three-dimensional tetrahedral shape, many organic molecules can exist in two distinct forms that are non-superimposable mirror images of each other.
Okay, what does that mean in plain English? Non-superimposable mirror images.
Think of your left and right hands. They have the exact same physical properties. They both have four fingers, one thumb, the same weight, the same biological components. They are mirror images.
Right.
But you cannot superimpose them perfectly on top of one another. A left-handed glove will never fit properly on your right hand, no matter how you turn it.
Right. They're geometrically distinct.
Exactly. In chemistry, these right and left-handed molecules are called enantiomers. Left-handed and right-handed versions of the exact same chemical. Now, in any unguided abiotic chemical synthesis, like a spark of lightning hitting a primordial soup or a reaction at a hydrothermal vent, the laws of thermodynamics dictate that you will always produce a 50-50 mixture of left-handed and right-handed molecules.
Because nature has no preference, right? It takes the exact same amount of energy to create the left-handed version as it does to create the right-handed version.
Yes. A 50-50 mixture is called racemic mixture. It is the natural, inevitable state of unguided chemistry. But biology has an absolute, non-negotiable demand. Biology requires strict homochirality.
Homochirality, meaning 100% purity of one hand.
Yes. For a protein to function, it must be constructed from 100% left-handed amino acids. There are no exceptions. Conversely, the backbone of DNA and RNA must be built from 100% right-handed sugars. If you have a mixture, the biological machinery simply fails to work.
So we have a pile of amino acids in our primordial soup, and it's a 50-50 mix of left and right hands. To understand why mixing them is so catastrophic, imagine you are building a spiral staircase from a huge pile of pre-made wooden steps. But half the steps in the pile are designed to curve to the left, and half the steps are designed to curve to the right.
And remember, blind chemistry doesn't have eyes. It cannot see which step it is grabbing.
Right. So you are blindfolded, grabbing steps at random and nailing them together. You grab a left step, great. Another left step, it fits perfectly. But then you blindly grab a right curving step and nail it onto your left curving staircase. You haven't just made a slightly wobbly step. What have you done to the structure?
You have utterly ruined the three-dimensional geometry of the entire structure.
Exactly. You've structurally poisoned the staircase from that point upward. The next left-handed step won't even fit flush. The angle is ruined. The staircase cannot turn into a functional spiral.
This structural ruination is what the text calls enantiomeric cross inhibition. Biological proteins function by folding into highly specific, complex 3D shapes, like the alpha helix. If a growing protein chain accidentally incorporates just one single right-handed amino acid, the side chain of that molecule points in the wrong direction.
It crashes into the other parts.
Yeah, it causes a stair clash. It acts as a structural poison pill. The protein cannot fold into the shape it needs to perform its biological job. It becomes dead, useless molecular weight.
And the mathematical probabilities of blind chemistry avoiding this poison pill are staggering. Let's do the math on this. Let's take a very modest protein made of 150 amino acids. To build that functional protein by chance from our 50-50 primordial soup, the chemistry has to blindly grab the correct left-handed amino acid 150 times in a row.
Right. The odds of a coin flipping heads 150 times in a row is 1 in 2 to the power of 150.
Which comes out to roughly 1 chance in 10 to the power of 45. A 1 with 45 zeros after it.
To put that in perspective, that number is roughly equivalent to the total number of seconds that have elapsed since the Big Bang, multiplied by a billion. and that staggering improbability is just to overcome the geometry problem for one small protein.
Just one.
Yeah. A minimal functioning living cell requires hundreds of uniquely coordinated proteins, all facing that exact same geometric hurdle simultaneously.
But surely there must be some natural chemical sorting mechanism. What if the pool just happens to be mostly left-handed by some fluke? The author makes a striking point about purity here. Biology doesn't work on a majority rule system.
That's a crucial insight that often gets glossed over. Some modern lab experiments have found clever ways to slightly amplify one-handedness over the other, creating maybe a 60-40 mix or even an 80-20 mix. But a protein chain that is 99% left-handed is still structurally dead. That one wrong-handed molecule destroys the fold. It must be 100% pure.
Pure perfection or death.
And even if, against all laws of probability, a localized prebiotic pool somehow miraculously achieved 100% purity of left-handed amino acids, it wouldn't last. Natural thermal energy and background radiation continuously interact with those molecules, slowly flipping their geometry back and forth.
Oh, so it undoes itself.
Exactly. This process is called racemization. Over a surprisingly short geological time, the pure pool will always revert back to the natural thermodynamic state, a 50-50 mixture.
So the natural state of dead matter is 50-50. The mandatory state of life is 100%, and nature actively fights to destroy that purity. Okay, so water aggressively breaks the chains via hydrolysis. Geometry poisons the structure via chirality. Let's keep playing the detective. Let's suspend our disbelief even further. Let's say we find a perfectly dry, warm spot. We somehow magically sort the left and right hands into 100% pure piles. We have the perfect building blocks, the amino acids and the sugar sitting right next to each other. Do we finally get life?
No, we get asphalt.
This is where the chemistry becomes incredibly frustrating for the naturalistic model. Chapter 2.5 introduces the asphalt problem. This is where the kinetic reality of chemical reactions goes to war with the origin of life models. What is the asphalt problem?
Well, we have to remember that a realistic prebiotic soup is what organic chemists call dirty water. It's an uncontrolled heterogeneous mixture. In the soup, you have amino acids, which you need to build proteins, and you have sugars, like ribose, which you absolutely need to build the backbone of DNA and RNA.
They're all floating around together.
Right. But if they are occupying the same space, they are not just going to politely ignore each other until they form their respective biological chains. They're going to react with each other.
Right. Chemicals don't know they're supposed to be building life. They just react based on their physical properties. And when you apply heat or energy to that dirty mixture, which is exactly what prebiotic models say you must do to drive off the water and force polymers to form, you trigger a very famous chemical reaction.
You trigger the Maillard reaction.
Let's explain this in extreme detail because everyone listening has actually experienced this.
Chemically speaking, the amino group, the NH2 part of the amino acid, is a nucleophile. It actively attacks the carbonyl group, the C double bond O part of the sugar molecule. When they react, they form what is called a shift base.
A shift base?
Yes. This shift base is highly unstable, and it rapidly undergoes a series of complex rearrangements and irreversible cross-linking with other molecules.
Now, if you're listening, I want you to picture your kitchen. If you've ever overheated a mixture of proteins and sugars in a pan, say, a sweet soy marinade on a piece of chicken or baking bread, you know exactly what the Maillard reaction is. It's what causes the beautiful browning of food. It creates complex flavors.
It makes food delicious.
It does. But if you leave that pan on the heat, what happens? You don't get a beautifully organized, self-replicating metabolic machine. The cross-linking accelerates. The mixture turns into a burnt, sticky, brown, totally insoluble tar permanently crusted to your skillet.
In organic chemistry, those complex tar-like polymers are called melanoidins. And the text highlights a devastating kinetic reality that cannot be ignored. The Maillard reaction is kinetically favored.
What does kinetically favored mean?
It means it happens incredibly fast. Yeah. Forming a useful peptide bond between two amino acids to build a protein is a slow, thermodynamically uphill battle. But the Maillard reaction between an amino acid and a sugar is millions of times faster. It requires much less activation energy.
So it's a race. We have the slow uphill race to build a protein and the blazing fast downhill race to build burnt tar. And the tar wins every single time.
It wins by an astronomical landslide. If you heat a prebiotic mixture of the essential building blocks to drink and build life, you simply kinetically accelerate the production of inert brown asphalt. The very building blocks required for life mutually destroy each other the moment they are energized together.
But wait, I see articles all the time in major science journals about researchers creating life's building blocks or linking them together in the lab. If the unguided chemistry naturally produces tar, how are these brilliant scientists getting these results? Are they lying?
They aren't lying about their chemical results, but they are omitting the context of how they achieved them. This is what the author terms the clean room fallacy. Modern origin of life experiments routinely bypass the asphalt problem by heavily cheating the system.
How do they cheat?
First, the investigators don't use dirty primordial soup. They buy 99% pure, highly concentrated reagents from chemical supply companies. Second, they run the reaction step by step in isolation. They don't mix the sugars and the amino acids together and hit them with heat.
So they keep them separated until the exact right moment.
Right. Third, they carefully control the pH, the temperature, and the solvent at every step. And most importantly, they manually halt the process and extract the desired product before the cross-linking Maillard reaction can take over and turn it all into tar.
So they're substituting intelligent, highly trained investigator management for natural, unguided processes. They are actively using their minds to steer the chemistry away from its natural dead ends. They're essentially playing God in the laboratory, successfully guiding the chemistry, and then turning around and publishing a paper claiming that the blind, unguided soup did it on its own.
Exactly. What these experiments are actually demonstrating is what an intelligent mind can force chemistry to do through extreme intervention. They're definitively not demonstrating what unguided Hadean geology would actually do. Left to its own devices, the chemistry produces asphalt.
Okay, that is a massive, crushing blow to the idea of an organic soup on the surface of the early Earth. The water ruins it, the geometry ruins it, the cross reactions turn it to tar. But what if we zoom out? Let's leave the ocean and the dirty puddles. What if the answer isn't on the ground? What if we look up to the sky? Does the atmosphere offer a way out of this trap?
That brings us to the famous Miller-Urey experiment from 1953.
Right, most of us remember this from high school biology textbooks. Sparking gas in a flask to make the building blocks of life.
The Miller-Urey experiment was historically monumental because it seemed to prove that you could get amino acids easily. But that experiment relied on a very specific, crucial assumption about the early Earth. They assumed the Hadean atmosphere was heavily reducing.
Meaning it was full of gases like methane, ammonia, and hydrogen.
Yes. Hydrogen-rich gases that willingly donate electrons to help build complex molecules. But modern planetary geology and geochemistry have definitively overturned that assumption. We now know from studying ancient zircons and volcanic outgassing that the Hadean atmosphere was not reducing, it was neutral.
A neutral atmosphere, what was it made of?
It was composed mostly of carbon dioxide, molecular nitrogen, and water vapor. It was basically the exhaust from giant planetary volcanoes.
And what happens if you take Miller's sparking apparatus and run it using a realistic neutral atmosphere of carbon dioxide and nitrogen?
The yield of biological amino acids completely collapses. You don't get the rich organic soup. Instead, sparking that neutral mixture yields high levels of toxic nitrites and nitrates. And these chemicals actively degrade and destroy any nascent organic compounds that might somehow form. The textbook experiment is just geologically irrelevant.
And then the text introduces the oxygen paradox, which is just a brilliant chemical catch-22. We touched on this earlier with the UV radiation, but let's dive deep into the paradox itself.
It is an insuperable physical obstacle. If you assume the early atmosphere contained absolutely no free oxygen, then there was no ozone layer. As we discussed, that means lethal UVC radiation intensely bombards the surface and destroys the organic chemical bonds via photodisassociation. You cannot build life under that radiation.
So to stop the UV radiation, you need an ozone layer, which means you must have free molecular oxygen in the atmosphere, perhaps generated by UV light splitting water molecules apart.
But where free oxygen is present, you run into the second half of the catch-22. Oxygen is a highly reactive radical scavenger. It aggressively oxidizes organic molecules. If there's free oxygen in the atmosphere or the water, it chemically attacks and destroys the fragile organic precursors long before they can accumulate into complex structures.
You are utterly trapped. If there is no oxygen, your biological building blocks get burned to pieces by radiation. If there is oxygen, your biological building blocks get rusted and oxidized into oblivion. There is no unguided middle ground where life can safely assemble.
The laws of atmospheric chemistry lock you out either way.
I want to make sure we are being entirely fair to modern science. Someone might argue, well, the Miller-Urey experiment is from the 1950s. Science has moved on. We have vastly better models now. To address that, the text conducts a realist audit of recent, highly publicized scientific literature from 2024 and 2025.
Yeah, sections 2.7 through 2.0.
Right. It looks at the absolute cutting-edge, modern attempts to solve these chemical barriers, and it meticulously shows how they all fall into the exact same traps.
Let's walk through some of those audits, because it reveals a recurring pattern of investigator interference. The author looks at an experiment published by Lee and colleagues in 2024. They made headlines by claiming a breakthrough in prebiotic synthesis. They used a chemical precursor called formaldehyde to significantly boost the yield of amino acids.
And the chemical finding is technically accurate, right? In their highly controlled laboratory, it worked.
Yes. In a perfectly controlled, purified lab setting, formaldehyde can drive that synthesis. But the realist audit steps back and asks, what happens to formaldehyde in a natural, uncontrolled Haitian environment? The chemical reality is that formaldehyde is incredibly unstable in water. Left to natural conditions without a scientist hovering over it, it rapidly polymerizes into a dense non-biological tar called hexamethylnitramine in a matter of minutes.
So the very chemical they are invoking as a prebiotic savior is actually just another powerful accelerant for the asphalt problem the moment it is released from the investigator's control. It just turns to tar.
Exactly. Then there's the audit of a 2024 paper by Jenna Wine and colleagues. They performed experiments using wet-dry cycles to create lipid bubbles. The press ran with massive headlines claiming scientists create protocells in the lab.
Protocell implies the precursor to a living, functioning cell. What did they actually make?
What they created were empty fatty acid vesicles. Chemically speaking, they are essentially just microscopic soap bubbles. They have a membrane, but they contain no genetic code, no semantic information, no metabolic machinery, and no enzymes.
That's just a shell.
Right. Calling an empty lipid bubble a protocell is a massive semantic leap. It is like pointing to an empty rubber tire and calling it an automobile. The hard part of life is not the container. The hard part is the information processing machinery inside.
And the text points out a fatal flaw even in the theoretical idea of housing that machinery inside those bubbles. This is called the magnesium paradox, and it is a massive headache for the widely popular RNA world hypothesis. Let's unpack the RNA world first. This is the idea that RNA came first, acting as both the data storage and the machinery, right?
Correct. The hypothesis is that early RNA molecules folded up and acted as catalysts, called ribozymes, to do the necessary chemical work of replication before proteins existed. But there is a massive chemical conflict here. For those RNA molecules to fold correctly and act as catalysts, they strictly require incredibly high concentrations of divalentations, specifically magnesium ions. The RNA machinery physically cannot function without a heavy dose of magnesium.
But there's always a but in chemistry.
But those exact same magnesium ions bind violently to the fatty acid membranes of those early protocells. If you introduce the high levels of magnesium required to make the RNA software work, the magnesium attacks the lipid membrane. It causes the vesicle to instantly crystallize, precipitate, and catastrophically collapse.
Are you kidding me? The exact specific chemical required to make the internal machinery function actively destroys the physical walls of the cell housing it.
The two systems are chemically mutually destructive. You cannot put the functional RNA inside the fatty acid vesicle because the chemical requirements of the former obliterate the latter.
That is just incredible. Okay, what about the other major origin theory that gets a ton of press? Alkaline hydrothermal vents. Nick Lane and other prominent astrobiologists champion this idea. They argue that life didn't start on the surface. It started deep in the pitch-black ocean at these towering chemical vents. They say the vents naturally provide heat, minerals, and crucial proton gradients to drive life's first engines.
The hydrothermal vent hypothesis is visually compelling, but chemically, it doesn't escape the barriers we've discussed. It actually magnifies them. Hot, pressurized alkaline water deep in the ocean aggressively accelerates hydrolysis. It turns the water scissors into water chainsaws.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the biological polymers break down even faster.
Yeah.
And the heat actively accelerates the male reaction, rushing everything toward the asphalt problem.
But what about the proton gradients? They argue that the vents naturally have a difference in acidity that mimics how modern cells generate power.
That is true. The vents do have proton gradients. But the logical leap is fatal. To use a proton gradient to do biological work, to actually generate cellular energy, a cell requires a highly specific, staggeringly complex biological rotary motor called ATP synthase.
An ATP synthase is a massive, irreducibly complex protein machine. It has a rotor, a stator, a drive shaft. It is encoded by vast amounts of precise DNA information.
Exactly. Proposing that deep-sea events drove the origin of life simply because life currently uses proton gradients is a classic bootstrap fallacy. You are assuming the pre-existence of the incredibly complex biological machinery, the ATP synthase, required to harness that environmental energy. A proton gradient washing over dead chemicals does not spontaneously build a microscopic rotary engine any more than wind blowing over a junkyard spontaneously builds a windmill.
Okay, I have to push back one more time because origin of life researchers are smart people. They know about tar. They know about hydrolysis. I've been reading that because isolated step-by-step chemistry fails, scientists are pivoting to a new paradigm called systems chemistry. They're acknowledging the messiness of the primordial soup. They're arguing that if you have a massive, chaotic, complex network of thousands of reactions all happening at once, life will just somehow holistically emerge from the complex dynamics of the network.
The author addresses this pivot to systems chemistry directly. Systems chemistry is an honest attempt to model the heterogeneous, messy reality of the early Earth rather than hiding in clean rooms. But as a solution to the origin of life, it is a retreat into obfuscation.
How so?
Expanding a blind, unguided chemical network from 10 reactions to 10,000 reactions doesn't magically increase the odds of functional, semantic, biological information emerging.
Yeah.
What it does do mathematically is exponentially increase the number of cross-reactions available.
And what do those cross-reactions lead to?
They lead straight to the Maillard reaction. By increasing the complexity of a completely blind chemical network, without biological enzymes to direct the traffic, you aren't increasing the chances of life. You are simply building a wider, faster, multi-lane highway straight to maximum entropy tar. The network dynamics accelerate the death of the system.
So what does this all mean for our investigation?
Yeah.
We have navigated a massive, exhausting labyrinth of chemical dead ends. Let's pull this all together. Let's build a quick, easily memorable study guide for you, the listener, so you can walk away grasping the core scientific arc of this entire detective story.
A synthesis is absolutely necessary here because the individual chemical clues don't exist in isolation. They all point toward a single, unified conclusion about the capabilities of unguided nature.
Okay, listener, here is your definitive cheat sheet for the origin of life's physical and chemical barriers. The mission of our investigation, we are trying to uncover how unguided, blind chemical physics could write semantic, functioning biological code. Clue one from the realm of physics. The universe is perfectly fine-tuned to an astonishing mathematical degree like Dick's gravity ratio and Penrose's initial entropy for planets and chemistry to even exist. The stage is set perfectly, but physics only allows chemistry to happen. It does not write biological information. So we zoom in on the chemistry of the early Earth, and we immediately hit four massive physical walls. Barrier one, hydrolysis, the water paradox.
Water is the absolute required solvent for life to exist, but thermodynamically it acts as aggressive chemical scissors, constantly cutting biological polymer chains apart vastly faster than blind chemistry can accumulate them.
Barrier two, chirality, the geometry problem.
Nature universally produces a 50-50 racemic mix of left and right-handed molecules. But functional 3D biology requires 100% geometric purity. A single wrong-handed molecule randomly incorporated into a chain acts as a fatal poison pill, permanently ruining the three-dimensional folding structure of the protein.
Barrier three, the asphalt problem, the kinetic trap.
Mixing the essential building blocks of life, sugars, and amino acids, along with the energy required to link them, doesn't build living code. Kinetically, the chemistry races millions of times faster toward the irreversible Maillard reaction, yielding inert, sticky, cross-linked brown tar.
Barrier four, the clean room fallacy, the illusion of laboratory success.
Every highly publicized laboratory success in origin of life research secretly relies on heavy, intelligent intervention. Chemists bypass the natural chaos by artificially purifying reagents, controlling environments, and stopping reactions manually. This proves only that immense intelligence is required to navigate the chemical hurdles, not that the blind early Earth could do it.
Looking at all this evidence, what is the grand narrative arc here? What is the final verdict of the chemical audit?
The overarching narrative arc is undeniable. The fundamental unguided arrow of chemistry points consistently and forcefully toward thermodynamic equilibrium, structural disorder, and tar. Chemistry physically, kinetically, and mathematically resists the formation of a periodic information-bearing complexity. The natural building blocks of life are actively hostile to the spontaneous, unguided assembly of life.
Thank you so much for taking this deep dive with us. I want to thank you, the listener, for surviving this intense, rigorous chemical gauntlet. It is a massive amount of dense science to digest, but the main takeaway is profound and worldview-shifting. The physics of the universe sets a perfect, incredibly precise stage, allowing for life to exist, but the unguided, blind laws of chemistry actively fight against its initial assembly.
It is an empirical reality that forces a profound reevaluation of the naturalistic assumptions science has confidently held for over a century.
And as we sign off today, I want to leave you with one final provocative thought to mull over, something to explore on your own as you think about the living world around you. Think about a blank book and a bottle of ink. If the physical medium itself, the chemical ink and the paper, actively resists being bound together, and more importantly, has absolutely no physical power to dictate the semantic words, the poetry, the instructions written upon it, where did the message come from? If the message is distinctly separate from the medium and the medium fights the message, what is the source of the biological software? Keep investigating, keep thinking critically, and keep asking deep questions. We'll catch you on the next Deep Dive.